This episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by listeners like you. Visit patreon.com/thecitadelcafe to find out how you can become a patron and help make this show possible. This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 241 for Tuesday, August 15th, 2017. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into. Joining me tonight, Mr. Brockett Vola. Hello, sir.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm going to break the rules because it's on my mind, and it has been muggy and disgusting in Halifax, and it is no longer. It is the humidity is broken, and I'm feeling rather comfortable in my own home. Which it just makes podcasting more pleasant when I don't have a drip of sweat going down the end of my nose, you know,
right?
Because yeah. I have an air conditioner. So during the day, my work day is just fine. But of course the thing is bloody loud, so I can't have that on when I record a show. But other than that, things are good. On an even more positive note, so the weather is looking up, the sun is shining, and I released a book this week. We finally released Piper Thibodeau's Daily Paintings to the public. It is 100% out there. You can buy it at forgepublishing.com if you happen to miss the Kickstarter, if you missed the pre-order. All of our previous orders have been fulfilled, which means there's no wait. So my fulfillment guy is on a trip right now, but he's going to be back by the end of the week, which means that when he gets back, he's going to be fulfilling the orders for the week, which is what he would be doing anyway. He doesn't necessarily do those daily. It would be like he grabs everything that was ordered that week and makes one trip to the post office. So Dave Michael from Sales Geek, I can't speak highly enough of Dave. I've had a wonderful experience, and he was a key person in the whole thing from Kickstarter all the way through to fulfillment. But backers are loving the book. People that are receiving the book are really, really happy with it. And now we have an opportunity to let people that missed the Kickstarter go out and buy it and support Piper and pick up a copy. So head on over to forgepublishing.com if you're curious, and you can see all kinds of stuff. Also, we've put up prints from Piper. It's the first time ever she's been selling prints online, so you can check that out too. But
nice.
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that a copy landed on your doorstep.
Yes, we have a copy. We have a copy of the Space Otter and Dandelion. Those are the big ones that we got.
Yeah, those are my favorites.
There was one other, I think, Tiger Lily.
Tiger Lily and Dandelion would be very tempting to get together.
Right, exactly. But when you release the picture of the front cover, like at first the Kickstarter had the Space Otter as the sort of emblem of it.
Yes.
And so we loved that. But when it became apparent later in the process that the Space Otter was not specifically on the cover of the book, and then we had the option for it. My wife's favorite animal is pretty much otters. We do the whole, I mean, if it's not cats, it's otters. So of course we got Dandelion and Space Otter. Those are our favorites. We love those. And then, nice. You know, we've got some of the other cool little goodies. It was really great. I mean, it's beautiful. I color me stupid, but I didn't even realize there was going to be like so much like text inside. So I'm really looking forward to actually reading it. This is probably my first art book other than like Art of World of Warcraft 3, which came with like the Legendary Edition or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But then again, that's more about like the full design and concept of everything as opposed to a specific artist's, you know.
Yeah, well, and that's what we were going for when we designed the book was something that looked and felt like an Art of Pixar or an Art of Disney book. And those would take a number of artists, you know, storyboard artists and background painters and modelers and character designers, and kind of put them all into one book, with the project being the things that ties them together. With the books that Forge is doing, what we're setting out to do is take the artist as the main theme and then tie their work together over the course of a book. And Piper, as much as you can look at her stuff every day and realize very clearly that it's hers and that she has a very distinct style, you can see throughout the course of the book that things change. You know, obviously she gets better over the course of 4 or 5 years as she's working on things. But I also found that just even her approach and her ideas, and you can see the concepts change and the approach change. And I think that one of the reasons we wanted to put so much writing in it is because as a fan of art books, one of my beefs is sitting down and flipping through someone's like collected sketchbook. It's like 60 to 80 pages. It's beautiful, but man, is it over too soon. It's like reading a 26 page, you know, staple bound comic book, right? Like, mm-hmm. you're like, that was awesome, but it took me 15 minutes, you know? And that's, yeah. and that's the thing with the sketchbooks. I love them and I return to them, but ultimately I do go through them quite fast sometimes. So I wanted an opportunity, in Piper's book to slow everybody down. So I basically sent, once we had curated the list of drawings or paintings in the book, I sent the list to Piper and I said, anything you can think of. I don't care how dumb, how funny or not funny you think it is, write it down and put it in the spreadsheet next to the image number. And myself and Kristen, the editor, will go through it and we'll pick the ones that we think really work. I'll pick ones that fit the layout and ultimately try to get as much information, you know, verbally in there as we can as well. And plus she wrote like 3 or 4 chapter headers and all that kind of stuff. So ultimately it ended up being quite a lot of writing, which I thought was really cool because it's nice to kind of have that inside information. And when you're dealing with artists online, I find that unless they're actually verbally explaining their process and doing videos and doing blog posts, most of the time it's a mystery to their fans. So to actually have Piper say like, hey, I'm really into like, you know, weird creatures and here's a Cyclops dog from Russia folklore, you know, like that kind of thing I find is really kind of interesting. You know, people are like, really, what? Really? That's where you got that idea? I just thought it was a one-eyed dog, you know, like just, but people, you know, it's an interesting kind of take on things. But I appreciate that. I'm glad that you and Laura liked the book and I'm really appreciative of your support for Piper because you guys were backers, I believe, right?
Yes, yeah, we were backers. Yeah, we were pretty much just like, well, you know, I see the daily drawings that Piper puts out all the time. So, you know, I've even shared a couple, like when she's done like different animals in particular that I love and whatnot. I just shared one for my buddy Adam because it was a Chrono Tigger. It was Chrono Trigger plus yes. Tigger from Winnie the Pooh, and he likes Winnie the Pooh and he liked Chrono Trigger, so it was pretty much right up his alley. Like, so there's certain ones, right? Like, yeah, exactly. I've shared, you know, when she did her Pokemon ones for a little bit, I would share those and those sort of things. So they've been fun just to share even on social media like Facebook, but beyond that, it's really nice to have an imprint form and have all those prints. It's really cool.
Yeah, I like unplugging and looking at them. I find that it's nice when you don't have to necessarily zoom in or look at it on your phone and stuff like that. Well, before we get into the Game of Thrones chat, I do have to get some more Patreon news out of the way. It's pretty straightforward. The changes that I outlined last week on the show have been implemented. So I had to delete the old Patreon reward, which allowed people to join the patron-only Slack chat. That Slack chat is no more, as is the reward. So if you are a patron, I really appreciate your support, but you may want to pop over to patreon.com/thecitadelcafe and take a look at your reward and then re-choose it. If you were backing the show before when we deleted the reward level from 2012, 2013, it removed you from the reward and put you in a no reward section. The new reward is up. It's very similar. It's worded very, very similar. And it's all the same idea of just basically, you know, entry level, whatever you want. But instead of a Slack chat, we have a Discord chat. And that was actually at the advice of Ryan Murphy, who's been on the show and does Gamers In and a bunch of other stuff. And he really enjoys Discord, and I was aware of it, but it wasn't super familiar, and he kind of gave me the rundown, and then once he kind of informed me that it was integrated into Patreon, that's what really made me do the switch. And already, we've only been in there a week, and the community around Slack that was there has migrated, and it's already a better situation. I find it a more social platform. There's instant voice. Like if you pop into the voice channel, people can just pop in and chat with you. I didn't realize I was in a voice chat. I was actually in there by mistake. And Adam Christensen from MacCast popped in and said hi. And I was like, oh, hi, Adam's in my headphones. How are you? You know, but it was fantastic. Like, I mean, it was one click. There's no calling anybody. There's no nothing. As soon as you enter in that chat, you're hearing like the dead air from that other person's microphone. So like if you're in that audio chat. Don't be munching on, you know, a carrot, because you're going to drive people crazy. But it like something like that, like if you're in a game like Minecraft, or if you're just wanting to pop in and have an audio chat where typing just isn't working for you, you don't have to call people up on Skype. You don't have to it's a really, really smooth thing. So, I really appreciate the advice from Ryan, and I'm happy with the switch over to Discord. But I do have to kind of encourage people on the Patreon to take advantage of that. So if you are currently supporting us, make sure you go claim your reward, because it's totally worth it. And that's at patreon.com/thecidilcafe. Now for me, I'm a little bit behind on episodes. I had planned to do the Spoils of War episode 4 from Game of Thrones season 7 last week with Megan. But Megan and I could not line up our schedules. I was actually not feeling well the night we were supposed to record. And then the Dartmouth Comic Arts Festival happened, and I just couldn't catch up. And so we missed it. So you and I are going to tackle episode 4 and 5. Arguably, I think we're probably going to talk about 4 more, because 5 was cool, but just a lot of setup for, I think, what's going to be 6 and 7. Forewarned everybody. I mean, you've probably seen and taking in episode 4 by now, but if you have not seen episode 5, you may also want to bow out now, because we do get into spoilers when we talk about Game of Thrones. For episode 4, it's called The Spoils of War, and I mean, straight up, this is the one where Dany takes the dragon in the battle. So if you haven't seen that, you need to. I can't just wait until the end of this discussion to talk about that scene. For me, it's still the one thing that I remember when I think about that episode. And when she leans into Drogon in any way and says Dracarys, and he unleashes on people, it never gets old. It doesn't matter whether he's the size of a horse or the size of a 787. It's phenomenal. And he is about the size of a 787. Like, he is, maybe not that big, but he is huge now. And I'm really digging it. I thought the reveal of him coming over the ridge with, like, just behind the Dothraki cavalry kind of coming in was just brilliant.
It's funny, because the prior episode, it was all about the really well-written reveal of the plans of Tyrion and Casterly Rock and all that stuff. And then the reveal that actually Jaime was marching on the Tyrells, and then they win there and stuff. So it was sort of fun to see. And I understand a big complaint of this season has been, it's funny because there's so much good stuff in the season that, of course, like, there's also a little bit of the complaint of, like, well, all the prior seasons were 10 episodes, and they also felt like they were a little bit more drawn. And so some people were like, nah, this episode was boring. And now, like, things are happening so fast, people are like, man, I'm kind of, I wish it wasn't so fast. It's like, well, you get what you ask for, which is, like, just battle after battle. Like, I remember every other season was just, like, one big battle. The whole season is usually, like, episode 8 or 9. Mm-hmm. And now this season, like, when we get to 5, it'll be funny, because everybody is pretty much going to say 5 is very ho-hum, because it's literally the only episode that didn't end with some kind of massive conflict at the end. But but this conflict, I mean, honestly, I didn't expect, first and foremost, because it's funny because they're, you know, Jaime and them are, and Bronn are all taking the loot back. And it's interesting because it's definitely a setting for a battle. Now that I think about it, there have been plenty of battles on big open fields. Like, that makes sense. But I guess it just is a setting for a battle that we just never expected coming, which really and truly was basically characters we like on both sides, one of which being Jaime and the Lannisters, who we're very familiar with, especially after last episode. But then we get our first, like, Dothraki on Westeros thing, going all the way back to Robert's discussion of the Dothraki being, like, never meet them on the open field. Mm-hmm. Here it is. And, like, on top of that, like, as if it was already not, like, grade B+, A-, like, everyone's itchy, like, well, will they? And sure enough, there's a dragon. And I also I think it's brilliantly smart not to bring in both or more than one dragon. Mm-hmm. But overall, it was just very gratifying. I think anybody who was watching that was riveted and forgot for like the, you know, 7 to 8 minutes, the last part of the episode, like all their complaints about speed, because they were finally seeing what was promised since pretty much we thought this was going to happen, which was dragons, Dothraki, on Westeros, sticking it to people we don't like, except sort of a few of them. But I wanted to ask you, Joel, I know, and again, this is pretty good, because at the end of HBO episodes on HBO Go, they kind of do this thing, which was annoying at first, but kind of is interesting now, where they talk to the writers about the episode and they kind of highlight points. And one of the points they highlighted in this episode was they really liked writing this episode, knowing that the audience was going to be conflicted over Jaime and Bronn, assuming, of course, that you were invested in them. And I think for the most part, we are. But how did you feel when basically for a brief moment, it really and truly looked like it was going to be either Drogon slash Dany or Bronn making it out of this fight? I know they kind of worked their way out of it, but for a brief moment, what was your thoughts? Were you picking one or the other? Were you just closing your eyes, hoping that everyone came out with like smiles on their faces?
Yeah. I'm team Daenerys. So, I mean, I kind of wanted and knew that she was going to be, on the winning side of that. Like once you see you see all the pikes go up with the Lannister army, they know their stuff. I mean, like, it's not like they're slouches. And you see the Dothraki coming and you're like, oh, I mean, like, it's going to be a battle and there's going to be losses on both sides, but you kind of don't want Daenerys to suffer yet another huge loss. Even if she wins, like her cavalry and stuff is going to be hugely diminished if they don't break the line. Well, of course, as soon as Drogon came over the horizon, it's like, well, there's the hole in your line, because he burns a hole in it the size of a football field. And that's, I mean, that's the end of that. Like, once the Dothraki get on the backside of the Lannisters, like, that's the end. More concerned about, and I'm glad they didn't do it, was actually I thought they were going to kill Drogon. Like when Bronn got to, my dad pointed this out, when Bronn got to the one wagon that Drogon didn't burn to ashes.
That's highlighted by a gorgeous golden sunlight in this smoggy atmosphere. Yeah, exactly.
The one that housed the ballista. Like, I mean, it's the one wagon to rule them all. But anyway, when he got to that, and he shot and there was a real threat, and I thought, okay, wait a minute. Like, if he hits this dragon, like, I don't think they're going to kill Drogon, but man, I would be really upset if this is how Drogon dies. And they hit him, and I thought for a minute, like, he was really going to be out of it, but they went the other direction, and he kind of was able to kind of muscle through it. Still landed. It still wasn't something he wanted to do, was fly with that thing in his shoulder. But the fact that it didn't like crash him into the ground, I thought was impressive too. It's like, wait a minute. So now you've just made him mad.
Yeah, you know? It was interesting.
I mean, there's that slow scene where they're trying to deke you into thinking that Bronn is going to shoot it right down his mouth, right? He's going to open up to breathe fire, and Bronn's going to fire it at just the right minute, which I think would be terrible. I would be so annoyed if that's how any of the dragons die. But something my sister pointed out was that this whole fight brought up the idea of a dragon dying. And the fact that my sister thinks that the White Walker, the king of the White Walkers, the Ice King, is going to get his own
dragon, the
Night King, he's going to get his own dragon.
Oh, that's a fair point.
If that happens, I think what's going to happen is one of Daenerys' three dragons dies in battle, and the Night King resurrects it as like a Frostworm sort of idea. Yeah, that's the only way I can see him getting one, unless he's already got one that we just haven't seen, which would also be cool.
He's got like friggin' giants already, although, you know, obviously we had seen living giants before that, but
yes. Yeah.
It is interesting.
And that's what I mean. So, I mean, the impression and the communication that they're throwing out there is that, you know, he will assimilate anything that dies and then he brings it into his own army. So then you're kind of wondering, well, wait a minute. So what if a dragon dies and he gets his hands on it? Like, so that kind of thing. I was not worried about Bronn or Jaime. I didn't think Bronn was going to die. There was just too much. There's a little bit about this show that I do find predictable, is that if there's an awful lot of banter between characters, like witty stuff, then those characters tend not to be going that episode. Whereas if it's a lot more serious stuff happening, then there tends to be a real threat. Like, those people might be the last time that they're on the show. And I think that for me, I wasn't necessarily torn, because I mean, I didn't want Jaime to just get burned up on a horse. Like, that to me would have been anticlimactic, especially being so close to being reunited with Tyrion. Because Tyrion was on the battlefield as well, kind of watching.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's just some things about that where just like, no, I know none of these people are gonna go. I actually, when I was talking with my father about the episode, I called the opening scene of episode 5, which was Bronn hauling gasping Jaime out of the river. Like, I mean, that was almost verbatim what happened.
Yeah.
The next show. So like, there's some things I was like, yeah, I don't buy necessarily any kind of real peril. But like, I was concerned about the dragon. Like that, it wasn't Daenerys that was gonna die. It wasn't Jaime. It was, is he gonna hurt the dragon? And that was, it's funny. Like, that was my real concern.
What's interesting, and it's funny you brought up the Jaime thing, and I think it's something that we'll get to as well when we talk briefly about his portion of episode 5. But I keep waiting, and I think a lot of people are waiting at this point for a few certain things still to happen, like people's theories of Jon and Dany. And then another big one is, like, when will Jaime, like, finally, like, flip the switch and be like, all right, Cersei, you're nuts balls. Like, we're donezo, you know? Because he's gone on this whole, like, we've seen the Hound go through the redemptive path, and we assume at this point he's basically redeemed to the point where now we can heroically root for him on this next big quest. But like, Jaime, like, for a brief moment, because of how he's reacted this season and him hooking up with Cersei again in previous episodes this season, which was kind of like one of the first times where they had like a non-confrontational hookup. I mean, they had the one in the Sept, which was very like, ooh, Jesus. And not like any time they have any kind of thing sexually, it's okay, thumbs up. I mean, brother and sister and whatnot, but still, like, for the most part. But like, it was strange. And honestly, I guess it's the writer in me. Like, I really was looking for the poetic, like, okay, he gets weighed down to sink by his heavy armor and his gold hand. And I wasn't alone, because when I read articles, a lot of people were thinking the same things I was, which was literally the symbolic shot of, like, him floating through water. And maybe this was just, like, they, like, maybe if they had 10 episodes this season, this would have happened, but they don't. They have 7, so they're like, all right, let's move this. But, like, I really felt like there was going to be a moment where he'd look at all the gold weighing him down, his whole birthright, and shuck it, and then literally climb his way out of the depths and basically be Sans hand, Sans gold, and look, here I am, I'm Jaime Lannister. But instead, Bronn drags him out, which kind of is interesting because, okay, sure, this reinforces their friendship and they again have banter or whatever, but I just thought it was, before we knew he was coming out of the depths, I thought one of two things. One, it was going, they were going to make a very clear point, although they didn't linger on the shot enough, and Jaime's too big of a character for his death to literally be like a quick, like, cliffhanger death.
Yeah.
But I was like, either he dies weighed down by the gold, or next episode he comes up shucking it. But, you know, I think there are plenty of ways that everybody who's an armchair writer out there right now, having enjoyed these characters as long as they have, probably have in their own heads the perfect ways for people to live or die. So, but that was just one of the few ways I was like, oh, missed opportunity. But again, you know, they've crammed a lot in these 50 minutes that they use, or 50 to an hour.
Yeah. The one thing that you do kind of miss with the shorter season and the more progressive episodes is the progression of time. You know, like, there's a scene, not to skip too far ahead, but there's a scene in episode 5 where Jon travels to the wall from Dragonstone inside of the third act. Like, you know, but that would have been, I'm assuming, weeks, you know, if nothing else, it's certainly several days, you know, but it's, you know, I'd have to look up how long it takes to ride from, the King's Road, like do the King's Road from, King's Landing to Winterfell. But he's gone from Dragonstone, which is almost King's Landing, to Eastwatch, which is beyond Winterfell. So, you know, it's a long way. And they kind of do it in a couple of cuts. Like, there's a scene with somebody else, and then they come back, and he's at the wall. So that kind of stuff, it's hard to remember, you know, that is a huge passage of time. Same with Arya, you know, traveling to Winterfell, and how long that must have taken, and how long Jon has been away from Winterfell, with all the stuff that's happening with Sansa and Bran and Arya
and Littlefinger, kind of now, and Littlefinger,
all that kind of stuff is happening over weeks and weeks. Right. You get back into it and you're like, why are all of these North lords all of a sudden pledging fealty to Sansa and calling Jon an idiot? And you're like, because Jon has been away for months. You know, like, it just, you don't,
yeah, exactly.
You don't necessarily get, it's one of those few times where a show could benefit from something along the lines of like 3 months later, or, you
like
know,
like a tag or yeah,
just
sure.
something to kind of indicate it. Because what you could do without getting into text on the screen in other shows is show the seasons change, which you can't
right.
because
yeah,
it's
you
the
really,
long
it's
winter, right? Like you can't
exactly.
do that. So, and what they do and how they, the changing in weather and seasons in the show now indicates where you are globally. Like, are you
yeah.
south? Are you north? Are you, you know, seaside, like, et cetera. And I think, which is smart, because when you're looking at something, you have no doubt, oh, this is King's Landing, or, oh, this is obviously farther south, you know, in Highgarden or whatever. Or Dragonstone has got a very British Isles look to it. It's got mm-hmm. kind of like a White Cliffs of Dover sort of thing. I haven't looked it up. I keep on meaning to look up where they film Dragonstone, like where they film those scenes. It's got to be someplace like Scotland or Ireland or something like that. It's just, mm-hmm. it's beautiful. It's so, so nice. But yeah, like I think, I don't know, I'm enjoying the speed of everything. Like I like, even the quote unquote slow episodes where it's a bunch of talking heads and stuff, all the chess pieces moving, I dig them. Like they,
but there hasn't, I mean, like literally all that happens. Yeah, exactly. And then there's a fight at the end until we get to episode 5. But like, yeah. it's been impressive.
Yes.
Ugh.
Yeah, no, I agree. As far as like the rest of episode 4, mm-hmm. I feel like it was a nice win. One of my favorite pieces of the writing or non-writing, I guess, was Daenerys hearing that she's lost or that her sack of Casterly Rock was basically a bait, and that she lost Highgarden and lost Olenna in the process. And I think that when she wants to retaliate viciously, and Jon tells her, like, you're not going to make any friends burning people and cities to the ground with these things.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't then have a meeting or a conversation or a big round table with all of her advisors and then explain to the audience what they're going to do. They just cut away. She's like, what do you think we should do? And there's nothing. You cut before he says anything. And I love the fact that when you see her attack the Lannister while they're on the move, you know exactly what Jon's advice was. He was like, take out the money.
Mm-hmm.
This whole thing revolves around money. Take out the Lannister gold. Take out the Hardgarden stuff. If you can't have it, no one can. You know, mm-hmm. And I think that was really, really smart. And that was something that I really enjoyed about that, is that I was able to make that connection without the show spelling it out for me. And I think that's something that it's something that allows them to then move these things faster, because you don't have to have that longer talking scene of everybody hashing out, like, what's the next move.
Right. And they've had a lot of those scenes already this season, and we've all enjoyed seeing characters that used to only exist maybe two in a scene, now 8 of them in one room,
yeah.
having those conversations, particularly the ones with Dany, Varys, Tyrion, all these all-stars. I mean, at this point, this should be called Game of Thrones All-Stars, really. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, like, this is like the who's who, but like, they're all around that table, that beautiful map table. And oh my God, it just kills me. Anytime a movie or TV show where somebody like puts the miniatures of their armies and like slides them across or sets things up, like, that blows my mind. And I love it. Like, I love I don't know if your war rooms do that or not, but like, it's perfect. And for a lot of the season, it's worked out well, because you can see how Tyrion actually implements in certain circumstances and has a place in the council. And up to this point, he's done pretty badly. So it's kind of interesting to see, or at least he's been outmaneuvered. It's kind of interesting to see, like you're saying, like, some of these actions start to take place that are blow for blow maneuvering. And like, normally I think we don't get to have as many aha moments until several episodes later. So I think it feels more like a good boxing match pace. Whereas before, it's like, you don't get to see your hero do something until five episodes. Like, think how long it took for like Winterfell to be reclaimed and finally people could be like, yes, you know, but now it's like body blow Cersei, body blow Dany. Like, you know, like it's this great juxtaposition and it's earned in the sense because we know so much about the characters involved. So you don't have to spend so much time building up why exactly we got to tear down Ramsay. And in some cases, it's a lot of characters just like Bronn and Jaime versus the Dothraki horde. But in some cases, it looks like it's setting up other characters we probably care about. I know some people who really liked Cersei over the years. I mean, she's conniving, but she has never purported to be anything less than somebody who's tried to play this game for the best of her family, however she deems that to be. And if that's what you believe, then how can you fault her for taking actions in ways just because the Starks take actions and get themselves killed? Like, I don't know. I've never 100% understood people's absolute hate of like the Lannisters, particularly like Jaime and Cersei, other than again the incest stuff, which is, you know, wackadoo. But but you know, it's just interesting that we're finally at a point where, other than I would say probably about two people, Night King excluded, who actually have like depth character wise, everybody else is essentially, you can kind of call a semi-hero or anti-hero. So it's very interesting that we're gonna have to see all these people either kill each other or try to become the Avengers and defeat, you know, the Night King.
Yeah, I think that, what was that? I can't remember what this line is from. It's like, you either die a hero or live long enough to become the villain.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that
yeah.
a Batman line?
Oh, it's in tons of stuff. They use it in Batman, but it's commonplace. I think it's pretty much the heroic journey is used to nothing. Yeah.
I hear what you're saying about Cersei, and I think that one of the things that they did this season, which we talked about the last time on Citadel Cafe, was her murdering slowly one of the Sand Snakes, the daughter, and having Illyria watch her die as a reward, you know, for killing Myrcella. And you know, you forget with all the terrible things that Cersei has done, that she lost a daughter, and the daughter was innocent in all of it. That was an evil thing. It was a revenge thing, and it was an innocent that got taken. And I, you know, as much as you hate Cersei, you know, I liked that scene. It wasn't like it was poetic justice, you know, when she gave her the poison. And I think one of the reasons why so many, including myself, don't necessarily root for the Lannisters, it's that. When I think about it, I like Jaime and I like Tyrion. So really, that's 2/3 of the remaining Lannisters. I think what people associate with Lannister is Joffrey. And I think that's why. And because Cersei backed Joffrey and supported him, then she's just guilty by association. Not that she's that different. Like, I don't necessarily think that she's got the realm's best interests. She's got her best interests, maybe not even her family's. I would say her best interests are at the focus now. And I think, you know, I think that there's really going to be some interesting stuff, you know, coming up with the information that I think is popping around the show. How did you feel about the Arya and Sansa reunion at Winterfell?
I thought that was good. I thought it was funny. And it's one of those things where you don't know if it's probably written in script. But when Arya or Sansa, I think it's specifically Arya, mentions that the statue looks nothing like Ned Stark, Sean Bean, I was like, oh, that's on point, because it doesn't. Nope. And like, that probably was, honest to God, a production choice. Like, they probably weren't just like, oh, we're really bad at this. But like, at the same time, that's just one of those things that's really fun and nice. Like, there's small bits of brevity that happen that also feel slightly like nothing on this show. I mean, like Mad Men has been historically written, like, they would ask our actors, like, is there any improv? And they're like, no, right down to almost like, not the acting choices, but like almost down for beats, like certain things are scripted. Like, I seriously doubt there's a lot of, like, you know, Kit Harington on sets, like, I'm going to throw out this one-liner and see if it sticks. Like, maybe, maybe they've earned that, but, like, there's just certain things that are in the script that you just assume, like, are very much a choice. Mm-hmm. And some of the beats for comedy, even if they're dark beats, this season have really been fun to me. So I thought that was a great way, sort of, you know, because Ari's the last person to really see Ned alive. No, Sansa was also there, right? They're the last two Starks to ever see.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's a really interesting reunion, and it is fascinating because I think of everybody. You can say what you want about Jon's growth, and you can say what you want about Bran's growth, but you could really almost say that they were both destined for their paths. Sansa and Arya had so much horrific things happen to them and around them mm-hmm. that they've been crafted by this world, and they're both to some degree, and I truly believe Sansa is a master of whatever they're doing. I mean, Sansa's still going to make bad political choices, but I think at this point you have to give Sansa some serious credit for being around Littlefinger as long as she has, and obviously Arya has proven herself and she's a big fan favorite, but I think it was a very interesting reunion. And again, to the humor point, Sansa's throwaway about, like, wait until you meet Bran, essentially, was like almost laugh out loud guffaw. Like, yeah. Oh my God, Bran, yes, what a our weird, like, yeah. weird brother.
Yeah, yeah. Bran's home too, by the way. Yeah, I feel like, I mean, I know this outside of Game of Thrones, that Sophie Turner and I can't remember Arya's real name, the actor. Do you remember?
Oh, that's gonna put me. Oh, I'll just
Macy Williams? Up.
Maisie Williams, yeah.
Maisie Williams is a singer, I think. Anyway, they're kind of thick as thieves in real life. Like they're really close friends. I remember following them on Instagram or YouTube or something like that, and it was quite funny. You can see that a little bit, kind of in their sideways glances and some of the more mm-hmm. the lighter sister moments and stuff like that. I really enjoyed that it wasn't little sister coming home and it wasn't like met with immediate, oh, well, they're back and they're back to bickering. Like it was really like both characters had grown, you know, to the point where even though Arya had grown into this hard kind of like spy assassin, she was still really happy to see Sansa. And it was, you know, she hugged her back. Like the first hug was like, whoa, this is weird. And then the next one was like, no, this is good. You know, and I'm glad that they played it like that. And there's still spats, like there's still some disagreements and some ruffled feathers, but and a lot of that has to do with what Arya is and where she's been. But with Sansa, like she is just like the Stark kids are home. Like we're just, you know, I'm the only thing that I'm really disappointed so far is that we still have yet to see Jon and Arya meet, and now John's beyond the wall in episode 5. So like I just it's a little frustrating that John has not seen Arya yet or even knows that she's back at Winterfell, because I think that would be a really really cool reunion.
That's probably though, like, and I don't think you're alone though, I think that's still like one of the number one meetups at this point. Yeah. And I think that's
probably season finale at this point.
Yeah, I think they're trying to push, there's still a few out there. And thus far, all the reunions have been pretty much what you would expect them to be, which is really interesting because there's still more reunions to come. But but it's interesting. How did you feel about the sequence with Arya and Brienne? So they spar, and the internet pretty much said Arya won. I felt like Arya won, but kind of also Brienne kind of got to a standstill. So like it was kind of hard for me to tell, but I'm one of these people who, when I read the books, was very impressed whenever they would list like this person beat this person in jousting and fighting and blah, 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 blah. Yeah. So you make this like top five fighter list in your brain. And as far as I ever heard, the Clegane, like the Hound and the Mountain was just a beast, like as body wise. So he was like one of the best. But Sandor Clegane the Hound was basically considered, if not the best, in all tourneys and situations. Like, then probably top two ever with like Barristan Selmy, but he was getting older, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So, like, I thought it was interesting that the woman who is so prominent, everyone's like, Bran beat the Hound, all this sort of stuff. And now Arya, like, quote unquote, beats Bran. I thought that was an interesting point to make as far as you know, because we remember seeing Arya with her little, I forget the name of her sword. It's
Needle.
Not Sting. Needle. And her, like, trying, you know, when she was with Lario? I forget her old master's name.
Yeah, but her dancing master, yeah.
Yeah, the just the growth there as a fighter, even to the point where the last time she saw Brienne, like, she probably couldn't have done, like, half of this. Mm-hmm. But she really has come a long way. And that was an interesting fight, all to be supervised at the same time by Littlefinger and Sansa. So it's funny to see sort of Brienne becoming Arya on the path to sort of being that Brienne type of figure, and Sansa being on the path to kind of becoming this Littlefinger figure, like, you know, very loosely. But it was very interesting. There was the schemers who were up top looking down, and the two fighters who were down pitting themselves against each other. And that was a very interesting divide.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're talking about with these sisters, that the paths they have done have led them down very different paths. And right now they're finding out that one another is not exactly, you know, they are basically what they were always kind of leaning towards. And it's interesting to see that come out of their personalities.
There's a line in episode 5 that when Arya addresses that, where she calls Sansa out on it, which I really like, that there's no angst, like there's no hidden feelings. Arya's just like, so you're in our mother and father's chambers now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because in Arya's mind, like, you know, his head's still rolling. You know, like, it's...
Yeah.
Like, these guys... I mean, it's been years, but, you know, to for kids to move into the parents' bedroom in the house that they inherited, I can imagine that would be weird, you know? So, but Arya calls her on it and just says, like, look, it's fine. You've always liked nice things. It makes you feel better than everybody else. And Sansa doesn't necessarily deny it. She doesn't take it as a compliment, but, she just kind of, like... Huh. So, and Arya is like calling her on this stuff, but she's not necessarily following through and saying, and it's terrible and I hate you for it. Or it's just, she's just kind of saying it how it is and not really judging either way, which I thought was really interesting. And Sansa seems to kind of accept that, but then also still kind of look down from the pile that she's sitting on and be like, yeah, well, that's how it is now. And I think that Sansa's got, I don't necessarily think that she wants Winterfell for herself, but I think she's at least planning for the worst. I think that's essentially what her motif is right now, is that she's like, well, I don't want Jon to die, but he's off doing some pretty dangerous stuff, and there's a really good chance that he will not come back. So I have to be ready, and I have to have the Bannermen in the North in my camp as much as they are his. Otherwise, I'm going to have to start all of that when John dies, as opposed to now and being ready for when John dies. And I think that also, again, to reiterate my point, like you forget how much time has passed and how long she's been ruling in the North. And so to us, it's like an hour and a half, you know, it's an episode or two. But to her, to settle into it and to get into a groove and then to become used to it and to become to like it, like, those are all things that would happen over the course of a couple months to just about anybody that's given that kind of power.
Right.
And I think that I don't necessarily see Sansa as a schemer. I definitely see her as someone who doesn't want to be schemed. So she's going to take precautions in that way. But I don't necessarily think that she is going to be scheming, with the exception of probably the best scheme ever on Littlefinger. I think she's going to be the one that kind of, like, catches him in whatever web that he's weaving. I think it's going to be Sansa that calls him out. I don't think it's going to be Arya, because we can kind of move on, I guess, into episode 5, just because this is where this is going. And there was more Sansa Arya in episode 5 as well. When Littlefinger gets real, he's doing all these little chats and Arya is shadowing him, and we don't realize it until the last minute, but he knows it. He knows that Arya is following him around. So he gets a scroll with a bit of information that he thinks is going to be valuable on it. And he hides it in his mattress, and Arya breaks into his room and finds it. And in the Wikipedia article, they said that the note was written by Sansa, and I think they got that wrong. I'm pretty sure that the note was written by Lyanna, which was Ned's sister. And what I think the note confirms is that John is not a Stark. And I think that's the bit of information that Arya now has and is delivering to Sansa. And Littlefinger wants that turmoil to happen because Littlefinger, in my mind, wants to be ruling the North. And I think I know he wants to marry Sansa. So I think he wants to somehow set in motion John losing the North to Sansa so then he can be rid of him and then, you know, be in there. Because we already know that in episode 3, John threatens Littlefinger flat out.
Right.
So if he can get rid of John, then his chances with in his mind, his chances with Sansa are that much clearer. But Lyanna is the only person that can or can't confirm John's true identity. And, I mean, obviously she's dead. So in order to do that, there has to have been some sort of record. And that's what I think he got the maester to dig up.
Well, see, what's funny is I think... it was just another circumstance where it was things have progressed really quick this season. Case in point, Sam, Journey to Old Town. I mean, like, whenever you introduce a new area, most of the time it, you know, like, we spend like forever there or whatever. Mm-hmm. But these last few seasons, like Dorne and Old Town have been like, okay, we're just going to pop in there a little bit, but we got to move these things along. But so, like, in episode 5, we see Sam essentially get pissed that all the maesters, like, get this information that the Army of the Dead's coming. They almost all basically acknowledge that could be true, but we don't know for sure. So let's see what else the maester up there can tell us. And then basically Sam's like, F this, you know, I pretty much cured Grayscale here, just one miracle down, but screw this, I'm going to leave. Mm-hmm. And like, it's really weird to me. And I think it's simply because they have to move things along. But Sam's time in Old Town feels a little feels the most convenient because he went to a center of information, basically saved Jorah, who shows up again completely fine this episode.
Yep.
And then like he talks to the maesters and then basically decides he's going to hightail it out of there, but grabs a bunch of scrolls, which, by the way, Old Town's filled with scrolls. How is he identifying, quote unquote, probably the master class of scrolls that are going to help him out? And on top of that, like, it's sort of a throwaway in the moment, but I think longtime viewers were like, ears were peaked when like Gilly's just matter-of-factly rattling off all this stuff from this old maester. And like, she straight up mentions the annulment of Rhaegar.
Yeah.
And then Sam's like so pissed off he glosses over it. And everybody else is like 2 episodes ago, you were pointing out Dragonscale in this big ass book. And now you're so grouchy that doesn't, you know, mm-hmm. Mr. Name Nerd Boy, like your ears don't prick up when you hear the name Rhaegar and annulment. But like, I think that was one of the few ways where they had to kind of put a pause on a big thing.
Yeah.
But it was interesting that like, Sam's time in Old Town has felt probably the most, minus a serious total flashback episode by Bran, which I'm not convinced isn't coming, but I guess at this point they've run out of episodes, so they probably won't do it. But I really feel like Sam's time in Old Town has become the most like Ex Machina-esque of like, he goes to the information center and he like zaps out all these ravens to all these people to be like, here's all this great information. And then, by the way, I'm going to leave now with what I assume is probably going to be super dope info. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that was probably the most – Sam's time in Old Town's probably bothered me the most. Also, I'm sad to see Jim Broadbent go because I love him. He was so fun. But that was interesting. So if that's the whole – if that's definitely going to be something that is held off until the last season, something people have suspected since the books have been out.
Mm.
I almost feel like that is either going to be twisted and we don't think what we know, or they need to just go ahead and reveal that crap. Because that's one of those fan theories that has lingered so long that's almost like,
so you're talking about the fact that you're talking about that John being a Targaryen?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, they confirmed it last season.
Well, who specifically said it? With the flashback?
It was the flashback with Bran.
With Ned and Bran.
It was Rhaegar that got Lyanna pregnant.
Oh, I see. I thought that was more like alluded to, like she was up there and then he helped get the baby out. I didn't know for sure that they had explicitly mentioned Rhaegar. Or maybe they did, but they tried to imply it was rape and not possibly love.
Yeah, and this would imply love. This would imply love. I thought, like, last season they definitely implied. Well, I don't know. She died during childbirth. It wasn't like she was she wasn't being attacked in the tower. She was
correct.
She died out of complications from childbirth. Mm-hmm. But from Rhaegar's baby, and Robert Baratheon, so in love with Lyanna, could probably only compute the fact that she was forced into it, not that she would actually leave him for Rhaegar.
Right.
And that's the whole situation that started the whole war, right? Like, that's why, that's the whole thing. So with that out there, I mean, that makes, and I got this wrong. I thought it was cousin, but my sister corrected me. John is Daenerys' nephew.
Nephew, yes. Nephew. Yeah.
Because everybody is just so close in age when they're sleeping with one another in these medieval stories that it just gets them so close. Which is weird, of course, because they're looking at each other kind of doe-eyed. And
Luke and Leia.
Yeah. But what I think is so interesting, and I think a great way to kind of open up some ideas towards other characters thinking that Jon's a Targaryen. And I don't know the history of this. I'd have to look it up in terms of the Game of Thrones stuff. But, like, why the dragons are so tied to the Targaryens and why Daenerys was able to do the things that she's done. And then to have Drogon land and obviously come in and try to show some threat and show some, like, alpha dog kind of, you know, posturing. And then all of a sudden kind of calm down. And Jon standing his ground, obviously scared because he's still never seen one of these things before, like this close, been this up to one, you know, and then to reach out and touch him, whether, like, why John did that, like, what was that, you know, notion? Maybe it's his experience with Ghost, but the fact that Drogon let him do it, like, Daenerys is watching the whole thing going, wait a minute, like, I'm the only one that can do this. You know, like, anybody else gets closer to Drogon and he tries to eat them, you know, like, and I think that is, it's something really interesting to see what that might mean to Daenerys and how that affects their relationship, because there wasn't really much beyond that. It was just like, well, I'm going north of the wall. Got to go. See you later. Bye. You know?
Yeah.
And he's off doing the heroic thing, you know? So we already know that Daenerys has a thing for the hero types. I think that, like, whether she realizes whether that makes him more appealing to her romantically, or whether she's now looking at him like, maybe I'm not the last in my house. Like, maybe there's a chance to rebuild and maybe I can trust in a stranger and maybe he's not so much of a stranger. You know, like, I just, I'm really curious to see how they did that. And I'm glad that they did that really cool scene with Drogon, because I thought that was really poignant and it was a nice way to do that. Again, way better than sitting around a table and having Sam read it out of a book. You know, which I'm sure is happening. Well, what's going to happen? It's going to be Gilly's, like, kind of like little hero moment when Sam and Jon and Daenerys are finally in the same room together, and they're going to talk about this kind of stuff. Daenerys is going to mention her brother Rhaegar, and Gilly's going to be like, "So that's the guy that I was reading about, the one with the annulment." And everybody at the table is going to go, "What? Like, wait a minute."
Yeah.
You know, I think all that's coming, you know, and it's one of those shows that you never know whether you're going to get an episode like episode 4, where it's going to be edge of your seat, like fist pump, or whether you're going to get something like episode 5, which still had a lot of really cool moments, like Tyrion, you know, meeting with Jaime. With the conversations that John, you know, got to have with Daenerys, and John was having with and now John's north of the, like, all of a sudden John's north of the wall with the wildlings and Clegane and the Brotherhood. Like, I mean, all of a sudden, like, you're talking about the all-stars, like, we're getting the number of locations that you're flipping between in the show is now down to 3.
Yeah. Right. Plus, they added Eastwatch to the map, by the way. That was really interesting. And this was named Eastwatch episode 5.
Yes. Yeah, it was. Yeah. No, and I don't know. I need to go refresh my memory and look at a really detailed map of Westeros and kind of put my brain. I know that Eastwatch is farther south than the Black, what's it, not the Black Gate. What's it called? The
Castle Black?
Castle Black. Yeah, Castle Black.
No, I think on the maps I've seen, it's actually the most. Like, it's like a...
It's farthest north?
It's tilted. Yeah, it'd be like the... Yeah, it'd be the... Like, if it's a slight diagonal,
right,
it's the further north.
Oh, really?
Which kind of... I mean, like... Okay, so there's some big theories going around about why the Night King is going towards East Watch. And apparently, like, some people have already dug through and seen that the Arrowhead Mountain that Clegane references when he looks at the fire is very reminiscent of a mountain that you see in one of the seasons where the Children of the Forest created the Night King, essentially. So maybe he's going back to his roots, going back to the place where he was born, and then that's how they're going to go wrestle up on Eastwatch. But I don't know. Okay, so Joel, do you feel that the plot to go get a dead person and then drag them down to King's Landing feels just a scotch kind of weird? Like, that, I don't, it's very, I don't know. For all intents and purposes, it's, this group is badass. And if any group can do it, and I love the preview of Dondarrion, who I don't even like, lighting his sword on fire in a wintry wonderland. Like, that was awesome.
I don't watch the previews.
Oh, I'm sorry. But, like, it's just funny that this is, like, a big, like, I love John. I love John to death. But, man, is John involved with some really stupid, let me go out and do this really stupid, like, heroic choice. And, like, I don't know. Like, as cool as it is with them walking out almost to certain doom, you would assume, like, I have to assume at least half of these guys aren't making it back. I mean, that's just me. Like, they're killing characters. Let some of these heroic people die heroically. But I don't know. It's weird. I feel like it's a very bad choice to go get one of these guys. I mean, there's an army of them. How do you just, like, wrestle up one?
Yeah.
And, like, what is it'll be interesting to see.
I thought it was a plot out of, like, the Flash TV show. You know, like, it's like
yeah.
I mean, like, it's one of those things where you'd expect to see this on a weekly superhero teen show. It's like, well, we have to go get one of these and bring it back and show proof that this bad guy is really coming because no one believes us. And I understand the need to convince other people. I thought he was going to be able to convince Daenerys to trust him just in terms of his actions, and so that she might say, okay, you know what, after seeing those carvings and after hearing you and heeding your advice and realizing you were right and all this kind of stuff, then maybe, and after seeing the dragon thing, yeah, you know what, I'm going to say, I believe you, the Night King is coming. Let's get together and try to stop this thing. But trying to convince Cersei of, like, the fact that they're going to try, I mean, it's, I don't know what's dumber, going to get a white or a walker to bring them down south of the wall as proof, or then taking that white to Cersei. Like, why on earth? I mean, and again, I don't think it's going to be Cersei. I think they're going to have to, I think Tyrion is going to have to, I think there's going to be a dodge. I think that they're going to say they're going to go meet Cersei, and the meeting there is just for show. It's just going to be fake. I think the real meeting and the real proof is going to be Tyrion showing Jaime Lannister the white or the White Walker, and that, and it's going to be Jaime they convince, not Cersei. And Cersei's not going to believe anybody, and that's when Jaime says, all right, I've seen it, and you still don't believe me, so screw you. Like, this is, we're all dead unless we do something. And I think the greater good is what's going to pull Jaime away from Cersei's clutches or thighs.
Yeah.
How you want to look at it. I can't, like, one, she's lying. She's not pregnant again. It's all of it is just, it's so, like, season one manipulation of Jaime. And it's like, God, dude, are you not really open? Like, have your eyes not opened to this yet? Like, it's a little bit kind of like, I'm in love with my high school girlfriend, and I'll do anything she wants. You know, it's a little bit tedious for me. But yeah, though I'm not a fan of the mission above the wall. I think it's going to be cool to see. I just don't necessarily know that it's going to be successful. And in terms of what, I feel like getting Daenerys and Cersei and Jon and all those people into a room, especially in King's Landing, is a bad idea. I mean, I can't believe it's going to be King's Landing. It's going to have to be somewhere as neutral, which is, again, why I think Jaime is going to be the one that has to go, because Cersei won't leave.
Yeah.
You know, she's not going to leave. She's not going to leave the throne room. Are you kidding?
But, yeah, exactly.
Any predictions for episode 6 before we wrap it up?
I predicted when this was called Eastwatch. This is when the White Walkers would make it to Eastwatch and crush it utterly. I guess that's not going to happen. So now my new prediction is, like, we see our lovely band, the Suicide Squad, dubbed by some people on the internet.
Oh, no.
I don't know. I think definitely some of these characters have won out their use other than their fighter, so they might be gone. Gendry would be an interesting character to make it out of this. For him to be introduced just to die, I think would be kind of stupid. So I think Jon and Gendry, for the most part, are safe. I think the Hound poetically should die in fire, so I can't see him dying out there, but no, maybe I don't know. So.
I think the Hound is going to make it back to Winterfell with Jon. And that's going to be an interesting Arya Hound reunion.
Yeah. Yeah. And Bran. You get like the full, like, which is funny because I think Tormund, people ship him and Bran a lot. But that's one of those few things where I think that's played up for comedy and less for like actual connection. Yep. And I think Tormund might be the quote unquote emotional death outside the wall. But again, I have no idea. I think this plan's stupid. It could. Like, John's plans tend to be somebody's going to have to save his ass when he makes a critical mistake. I would love it if John's the one that makes some great strategic choice outside the wall. Because when he was out there with the Wildlings, he made a lot of good decisions that saved his ass. Mm-hmm. So it'd be interesting to see that. But right now, my only prediction is that I think that's going to be an interesting episode, but I think it's going to be an utter failure. And really and truly what I think it's going to set up is the total decimation of Eastwatch, and that the season finale will possibly be more of a Emperor Strikes Back, like, oh, crap, we are screwed kind of sadness, as opposed to a triumphant, like, we've done anything right.
Yeah, I think the mission to get the White Walker will be successful, but it will also bring around the opportunity for the Night King to then take Eastwatch. So, like, they're in order to convince Cersei, they end up opening up the front door sort of thing.
I think there's going to be something that's bad there. And there has to be a couple of these episodes where everybody doesn't get something. So I think maybe next episode might be a break from Dany, since she's had so many, like, badass moment. So the season or episode 7-2 from here. And by the way, don't forget, there's only 8 more of these entire series. Like, that's it. Yeah. Supposedly. I mean, that's what they've announced. So keep that in mind. This is basically the end of it, even if this is not the quote unquote last season.
Well, so. I think this season it's very similar to how, like, you know, Harry Potter part 1 and 2 for that last movie. Like, I think we're basically getting a 15 episode season or a 14 episode season over the course of 2 years would be the way that I would look at that. But that brings us to the end of this episode of the Citadel Cafe. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything I'm doing online at joelduggan.com. You can follow Piper Thibodeau's book at forgepublishing.com. You can email this show at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com. You can follow us by name on Twitter and Facebook. And hey, you know what? While you're out there, check out iTunes and give us a review. It's a great way to bring new listeners into the show. The music for the show was composed by Kevin MacLeod. And last but not least, just myself on social media, just my name. I'm everywhere. Depending on what you want to find and where you're hanging your social media hat, just look for my name, Joel Duggan, and you shall find me. Brockett, where can people find you online?
Just look up some old episodes of Biggest Fan Podcast. There's some old archives of that you can check out.
You've been listening to The Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick 2.